All right, everybody, this show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever feel like you could use just a reset, somebody to bounce things off of, you know? That's what BetterHelp is there for. They're great for that, you know? Because let's be honest, it's helpful in a lot of ways. It's helpful for positive coping skills, how to deal with stuff, how to set boundaries. It empowers you. That's what BetterHelp does, to be the best version of yourself. You go online and boom. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, as I said, and it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited for your schedule. How much better does it get than that? You do it at home. Do it wherever you want. Do it on your own time, in your own space. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Pete today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, Better, H-E-L-P, all one word, .com/Pete.
This is the Pete and Sebastian Show with Pete Corielli and Sebastian Maniscalco.
This town is a lonely town.
Jimmy Carr, you're a legend. It's a pleasure to meet you.
The story I'd like to get to is when your head was shut in the elevator doors and became that shape. I think that a lot of our viewers will want to know at what stage that happened.
If you were nice to me, it would be weird.
Did you shoot? But George Lucas based one of the characters on that, didn't he?
Anyway. My father used to call me Vicehead. My own father, the man who made me. So,
used to call you Vicehead?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
So. I imagine you, yes. Was it you? I mean, I'm presuming we can trace this back to your mother's birth canal, and she sounds like a hell of a lady.
Was a hell of a lady, but my mother's dead now, but that's not going to slow you down with the insults anyway, I'm sure.
No, I'm not insulting. We're playing.
I don't know. Look, I know you. I know you, right? Yeah. And he's ripping you to shreds, right? But inside, I know you're like this fucking guy, right? Like,
swear to God, not with Jimmy Carr.
Okay,
no
okay,
way.
Okay, I'm just saying because
this is if he was nice to me, it would be weird. he's a legend for this. You know what I mean?
I know. I'm just saying. I know you. You're hot. You're a hot, you know, you're like...
I won't know anything until the Perrier hits me in the side of the head. That'll be the last
Jimmy,
thing I see.
You're crazy. Like I said, I've been around you. You're so incredibly funny, clearly an intelligent man. And like, I'm always amazed at like when you do those shows where comics make fun of each other, how quick you are, the thick skin you have to do that. You know, it's just all
that kind of roots me back to, I don't know how you guys got started in comedy, but I always think like the question to ask comedians is like that playground thing of being able to tease each other. That was kind of how you marked out like who was fun, who's cool to hang with. If they can't take a joke, just it's the worst thing you could say about someone is they couldn't take a joke.
Right.
I was thinking the question with comedians, like my best question with comedians, which of your parents was sick?
Like what, ill?
Ill. There's always like a sick parent. There's always like, in most comedians that I meet, there's like a parent that was either depressed or was physically sick and you had to be the thermostat somehow for the house. There's a mood in the house and you had to be able to regulate what, because really when you think about what we do for a living, there's 1,000 people, 2,000 people in a room and we regulate the mood. We come and we go, we're going to change this. We're going to change how everyone in here feels.
Mm-hmm.
We're drug dealers.
Yeah.
Right? We are. And we're dealing, it's the two best drugs. It's dopamine and serotonin. And we're able to kind of go, you know, it's a surprise where the joke, like the serotonin makes you feel good, but the dopamine, you don't quite know where the surprise is coming. You don't quite know where the joke is going to be. You know, sometimes when I watch your stuff, it's like, they'll just be in the middle of a joke. There'll be a turn of phrase and it will just like, you'll have to pause it. It'll be something so sticky. You just go, oh my God, I can't believe I've never heard that phrase before, but I know exactly what it means. And it kind of anchors you into something. And it's like, you're in hysterics. And then the gag, you never quite know where it's coming from. That thing, it's the same thing Vegas is built on. That dopamine hit. I don't quite know where the surprise is coming. I know it's coming.
Okay, so after the show, I gotta go look up serotonin and dopamine. Okay, because this guy's really... are we all right here? There's a lot of chit-chat.
Everyone keep calm. Keep calm. Am I gonna be okay? Oh my God. I just want to see my family again. I love the fact he's got the headset on. Somewhere between air traffic control and Madonna, but without the makeup. No. Madonna is 60, but she's got the body of a man half that age. Yeah. I mean, this is... That felt like... That's real status. There's always status going on in any conversation. And it felt like He was not going to criticize Sebastian in this scenario.
Speaking of criticize.
No, you're fine. You're fine. We'll move the mic to you. Right. The table's wrong. Sebastian's right.
I don't want to split hairs, but it's status, everyone, not status. But, you know.
It's status, not status. Yeah. What language are we speaking again?
I'm speaking English, Jimmy. Oh, English. I don't know what you're English. Floating around.
I don't know where you're from, but I'm from England.
I know. I looked you up. I'll went to some card. Very, very highly regarded college. I noticed that. But they're teaching you wrong. It's status.
I'm educated beyond my intellect, yeah.
So you go to this prestigious school, right? You have
I went to a good school, yeah.
Yeah, so well-educated.
12 Nobel Peace Prize winners came from his school.
Homework.
Did you know that?
Not Nobel Peace Prize. it's the Nobel Prize. So Nobel invented dynamite.
Jimmy, I was testing
He invented dynamite and then to give something. And then they reported his death. You know the story? You know what happened?
No.
The guy invented dynamite, right? So he invented dynamite, which is great. And it was used in a lot of wars to kill a lot of people. So he felt terrible about himself. And there was an obituary. Someone reported that he died. He hadn't died. They did the obituary. And it basically, they said, this guy's the master of death. This guy is responsible for so many deaths. And he went, that's my legacy. That's what they're going to say about me when I do die, because they already printed the obituary. I'm going to change it. So he gave all his money to this kind of endowment to pay people for doing good work in economics and chemistry and physics and the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's how that started,
yeah.
See, I don't... This
could
is
be
the,
bullshit, couldn't it?
Well,
don't know.
I don't know.
You know?
The way you presented it, I'll believe it.
Oh, I believe it.
And the fact that he knows these things, I don't know any stories like that.
Right.
Do you know how that came about? That's what you call education.
It is.
That's coming from a place of, I went to a school that cared. We went to a school. I went to Northern Illinois University.
Northern Illinois University.
Yeah, in DeKalb. And they don't teach where the Nobel Peace Prize came from.
No,
you added the peace too.
I know.
Are you sure it is not a piece? Because we're both saying
that's
peace,
a separate
Jimmy.
Thing. Yeah, it's a different thing.
Well,
the
that's
peace
the
prize.
One we're only talking about the peace one. You're bringing it back the other one.
Should have given it to Trump. They should have given it to Trump. I don't know what they were thinking.
Don't bite into that. That's bait right there.
he's trying to see if we're gonna go. You're right, bro. I do have to ask you one question though. Do you find that your intellect, which is, it's really impressive, man, and I knew it would be when I met you first, even seeing you from a distance and hearing you talk. Is it like getting wasted now in the sense that I could just Google, hey, how did the Nobel Prize come about? You know what I'm saying?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think like education is any formal education is kind of nothing. Everyone that knows anything in the world is kind of I never know how to pronounce it because I've only ever seen it written down, but an autodidact. So it's self-taught, right? Everyone's always like anyone that says anything interesting. Like if you meet a doctor, like a really good doctor, ask him how much of what you do did you learn at medical school? And it's maybe 5, maybe 10%. Mm-hmm. And then everything else is like they've learned it on the, I think life, just like being a comic and being out there, the great thing that we have is we have interesting conversations. It's like there's something about being a comedian. Even if you meet a stranger on a plane and you say, I'm a comedian, they don't know who you are. You have an interesting conversation. I've got a theory about it, about like friendship, right? Really good friends, right? Your best friend in the world. There's no filter. Right on this, it's a podcast. We're being recorded. There's a lot of cameras. So there's a bit of a filter up, right? We're not going to have the conversation we would have late night if we've known each other 30 years, right? Mm-hmm. It's a different conversation. Yeah. And the level of filter, I think with comedians, the reason people want to come and see a comedian live, people want to be in the room with you is because this guy's got no filter. This guy's calling all of the bullshit in a relationship, all of the bullshit in the modern world. This guy's talking about it. I've just got to live with it. But this guy has no filter and he's just, it's me up there. It's a lovely feeling of like that connection. You know that old Victor Borg quote, laughter is the shortest distance between two people. I love that when you really kind of connect.
Yeah.
Now you say filter, right? Now, in an environment we're living in, I know you've been controversial in some of the things that you said on stage. Are you filtering a little bit? Do you, maybe
I'm
this is-
I'm doing my best not to, because really there's two bits of censorship, right? There's a censorship from above, right? An authoritarian, you can't say that, which is what we had in the 70s, right? And if you look at the basket of things you can't say, it's much better now than it was in the 70s. Life is getting better, right? Look at George Carlin, the 7 words you couldn't say, the controversy around that when Richard Pryor did his third album with the title I cannot mention, but is an incredibly important piece of work. Those guys had limits on what they could say. You know, Lenny Bruce is getting arrested for saying stuff.
Yeah.
None of us are getting arrested. But the thing that's happening is it's coming the other way. It's self-censorship. So a lot of comics might write something, go, oh, I better not do that because people might not get that it's a joke. So I try not to. I try and treat everyone like they're a friend and like they get it and they're intelligent enough to realize it's a joke. I mean, I've got a whole bit in the new special about you can't go around apologizing for jokes. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do? You can't say, I've got a plan for next time. Want to hear this plan? Next time I get canceled, there's a big controversy about a joke.
I know the joke. It's
I'm going to say, I'm sorry. And the people that are offended will say, you don't really mean that apology. And I'll say, so you're saying I could say something and not mean it. Now you're getting it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's a brilliant way to explain it. I mean,
but it's that thing of like, it's slightly with the canaries in the mine as well, like comedians, like not just, I kind of think there's this concept of the Overton window of what you can and can't say in politics. What is and what isn't acceptable on the left and on the right. And the window is what you can say. And I think comedy pushes the social Overton window. So it pushes it a little bit with saying very edgy things. And then you can have more of a conversation. But also, you could do comedy that's not seen as being controversial. But the stuff that you do is like, it pushes it in relationships. You can have a more open discussion about your relationship after seeing the show. I was thinking like, why do people buy tickets for a comedy show? The conversation afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Conversation afterwards is amazing.
Yeah.
Because you can get into it. You kind of go, yeah, it's kind of, yeah. We all do that, yeah.
Yeah.
It's great.
So how do you take, well, for me, I don't like the backlash. Let's say if you say something and then you get attacked online or what have you. Do you feel it at all? Or are you just thick skin?
No, I feel it. It's a filter though. It's an amazing filter being canceled. Like properly canceled, front page of the papers, they ban this filth. This guy is awful. He's the worst. He's such a great filter. You find out who your friends are. And that's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's painful. But it's fantastic. If someone throws you under the bus, you go, well, okay, I need to spend any more time with him. Everyone's a fail with a friend. But when shit happens, you got to know who your people are.
Yeah.
That's useful. And then, you know, you've only really got to ask yourself one question when you get canceled, which is, who are you? If you know who you are, last time I got canceled, my friend phones me and says, well, who's Jimmy Carr? Well, I'm a controversial, edgy comic. Well, we don't have a problem then. You've got to right size it, right? There's real problems out there in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And people love comedy because they can forget that for an hour mm-hmm. and just enjoy. They've got tough lives, and a dark sense of humor sometimes helps in the worst possible times. It's like, I feel sorry for the people that get offended. When mm-hmm. shit happens to them and shit is going to happen to them, they have to white knuckle that shit. So I told the joke and some people didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Meh.
Yeah, it's fascinating what's going on now. And we're talking about Las Vegas. You're in Vegas. You're here tonight at the Mirage.
All right, you're playing a bigger room at the Wynn. All right, I get it.
No. And I want to talk about the dress. Talk about show business. You've always presented yourself very, very, I mean, it's 10:30 in the morning and you came in not only a suit, but with a vest. Now, has this always been a thing with you as far as presentation?
Well, I love America. I don't, there's nothing the matter with America. I've said it before, I'll say it again. It's objectively the best place in the world, subjectively terrible. People think they're having a terrible time. This is the land of milk and honey. It's extraordinary. And the next 20 years for your country will be great. The only thing I would slightly tweak if I was running for president here, and I think there's a gap in the market, would be maybe we could stop the grown men from dressing as toddlers. maybe that would be you wander around Vegas and there's grown men in shorts and you go, I mean, unless we're actually in the act of sports,
right.
Not on the way to the stadium,
yes.
In the act of sports, maybe.
Right.
Yeah.
No, and you know what? It kind of like rubs off because I have a pair of sneakers just to be comfortable walking around here. I went with my boots because I knew that Mr. Carl was going to come probably in a
this
suit.
This was you making an effort, like, was it?
Well, bro.
Phenomenal.
This is phenomenal. I mean, I got to be honest, you know, you look fantastic too, but in America, you know, it's too gentlemanly. I you know, like Sebastian was saying.
I think there's a lot of very well-dressed people in the States as well. There's a lot of kind of, I mean, actually the last special, let's talk about that. Your last special for Netflix, which was Vegas, and it was black. I mean, I loved it. I loved the look and the feel of that opening sequence. Do you know what it was? I think it was that thing of like, I was chatting to my friend Charlie Skelton, who's a writer that I work with a lot, about the last special, yours. And both, we kind of went, do you know what? It was that just thing of the first minute of it, you sort of coming on stage in black tie. Oh, we can relax. This guy knows what he's doing. This guy's a professional. Mm. Really put us at ease. It's a weird thing that, but awesome. Just it anchors you in the, this is like the Rat Pack.
Yeah.
The confidence.
I don't think there's many people that think the way you just explained. I think, especially now in entertainment, right? You look around the landscape, ain't too many guys looking at this as show business. It's almost the audience, though. The audience is looking up and going, this is foreign to me, tuxedo. I asked the people to dress up in the audience like it was Vegas, and like 20% came in a suit. We had to move people from the balcony who were in a suit down to the front row
to look good,
to make it look like it was, you know, people actually listened.
I love that thing, though, of like, there's a town in Britain, Liverpool. You know of Liverpool, of course, and the Beatles and all that. Liverpool's still got that thing. If you go out, if you play a gig in Liverpool, the Liverpool Empire, which I would recommend you do at some stage, such a great room and such a great crowd, and they all dress up on a Saturday night. Like, it's properly suited and booted, and it's like a little cultural thing there. It's a bit kind of, it's a little bit New Jersey. It's got a little bit of that kind of feel to it, but it's just, I think it makes it a better evening. I think it's that weird thing of like, people think they want to be comfortable, but not all the time. Actually dressing up, and it's a way of showing affection for your other half. You get dressed up a little bit. It's like, it's a different love language.
Do you dress up on you're not working. Are we going to get a cup of coffee ever in sweats, or is this the look?
This is it. Yeah, this is it. So dressed as a grown man at all times.
Wait, hold on, before that. I'm sorry. Yeah. Do you sleep in pajamas?
Of course. Yeah. Otherwise, I've got no pockets. Where am I putting stuff?
What do you need pockets for when you're going to
sleep? What if something comes up?
Like you mean a joke?
Something.
Yeah.
Something. I may have to make a note. We don't know. We don't know what could happen.
Man, the passion for stand-up, that you need pockets in case a joke comes to you and you want to write it.
Well, I was thinking,
I love it.
Who had
man.
The great observation? Mitch Hedberg had a great line about, you know, sometimes in the middle of the night, I'll wake up and think of a joke, and then I have to spend 40 minutes convincing myself it's not that funny, so I don't have to write it down. That strikes me. There's a lot of 4 a.m. going, I'm never going to remember that. I better write it down.
Yeah.
There's a great line. Who had it? Chris Martin had a great line of never refuse the muse. If something occurs to you, it's like, you can't refuse that.
Yeah.
Whatever that energy is, wherever that thing's coming from, of like constantly going, well, write that down.
It's hard to explain if you're not a comedian, though, but to get up in the middle of the night and write something down, it's like, I'd rather stack a cord of firewood. It's exhausting to just get out. You know?
Somehow you're in that mode of, oh, okay, well, I'm kind of, my mind now is whirring.
All right. Yeah.
I was thinking that's the downside to being creative. Obviously, everyone wants what you've got. No one wants to do what you had to do to get there.
Mm-hmm.
No one wants to have the pathology of a stand-up comedian, because it is that thing of like, I think it's quite like the opposite of anxiety is a creative mind. Like, if your mind has nothing to do, if you have shows for 3 weeks, you worry about everything and kind of counterfactuals and kind of, you know, just kind of being a bit kind of uptight because you've got nothing to spend it on.
Mm-hmm.
I think just writing seems to be the cure. Like, it gets it out of your system.
Yeah. What's up, everybody? Today's show is sponsored by BetterHelp, all right? Sometimes we all get in a funk. We've had rain every day. I don't know, is it making me depressed or is there something else going on, you know? And that's why with something like BetterHelp, they're there to have someone who's helpful with giving you positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. And they empower you to be the best version of yourself. You go to BetterHelp, you talk it out, and next thing you know, oh, I'm not depressed. It's been the rain that's been bothering me. I don't know what it is. All I'm saying is, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, and it's designed to be convenient and flexible and suited to your schedule. All you got to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Again, you hear what I'm saying? Licensed. Not Joe Schmo who just decides he wants to talk to you. These people are licensed. They're tight. They're ready to go. And you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. So find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Pete today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, Better, H-E-L-P, all one word, .com/Pete.
Do you pine over, like tonight you got a show, 1,000-seat theater, do you pine over ticket sales? Or is that something that, hey, I put my shows on sale. If they come, they come. If they don't, they don't. Do you ever worry about, is it half full? Is it sold out? Is that something that...
I'm very lucky, actually, with, you know, ticket sales or whatever. And we haven't been sort of too ambitious on this leg of the tour. But I tend not to worry about it too much. I don't mind if the room isn't like, you know, I do a lot of two shows a night. Like most places I play, I'll do a 7 and a 9:30. And, you know, sometimes the 9:30 is not, you know, full to the rafters in the States. It would be elsewhere in the world. elsewhere in the world, if you're listening to this elsewhere, I'm a huge deal. But here, here I'm like a curio.
Pretty big deal.
But the it sold out tonight and it'll be fine. You know, it'll be grand, I'm sure.
How did you become like a global superstar?
I think it's just like, I would so recommend. I did 45 countries on this tour. I would so recommend you do it. You know, I know you've got kids, it's hard to be away, but to go, I found like 20 odd years into the business, it just reinvigorated my love of it. Mm. Like going and doing stand-up in Australia and kind of go, okay, what works, what doesn't work? Or I did like 12 countries in the Far East in January. And it's just this thing of like, people have got the same sense of humor all over the world. Everyone speaks incredible English now. I think it might be the Netflix effect and the YouTube effect that people watch stuff immediately and they're not waiting for it to be dubbed into the local language. So they just, their ability. And really, it's not about the high point of language. It's not dreaming in another language. It's getting a joke in real time. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people, I travel a lot in Eastern Europe, learn English through watching comedy.
Oh, wow.
Which is a beautiful thing. It's lovely because they know they get it. They know if they're laughing with the audience, they know they get it.
Yeah, I haven't ventured really outside the States. Some in the Middle East in 2008. It's in Australia, but to your point,
people would love it if you traveled.
I get it. I struggle with, I got two small kids, 6 and 4.
Yeah, that's the reason to leave. But you've had this upside down. I don't know if you've experienced a lion and room service breakfast, but please, if you thought it was good before kids, wait until after. It's an absolute joy. I mean, having kids is really, it's changed my priorities. Like, I used to think I wanted kids. That's gone. We were thinking about, you know, what do you got, 2?
Yeah, 6.
We were thinking about what the perfect number is. And I think we're ready to take the plunge and get rid of both of them. It's glorious. It's the best thing in the world. But it's also, you know, going to work and having that sense of adventure as well is important. And I don't go away for that long. You know, when you go, even when you travel around the world or whatever, you don't have to go for that long, you know, 3, 4, 5 days and then you're back and it's exciting to you're always looking forward to something.
Yeah.
You're always kind of looking forward to this next thing. But it's a weird thing now because Netflix streams globally. I'm sure you could play anywhere in the world.
Well, I mean, you could go to anywhere in the world depending on, you know, I mean, I've never been to England to do stand-up, which is,
I feel like the Palladium on a Sunday night would be your, because that's kind of like Vegas. Sunday night at the London Palladium used to be a TV show and it's very glamorous. It's an old theater. It's a 3,000 seater, but because of the age of the theater, I mean, it's older than America, the theater is, and it's the old theater is always better to play because of the seating regs. So the seats are packed together. People used to be smaller. So they're just packed together. They're in tight. So it's 3,000 people, but no one's that far away. It's a glorious, glorious room. Mm, I mean, you would kill. And maybe wait a few years, maybe do it with the kids. Maybe travel with the kids.
Yeah, that's my plan. Once they get old enough to kind of like maneuver around, and they're getting there, they're 6 and 4. We can maneuver with them a little bit more with ease traveling. Maybe I'll take them. But here, for example, I'm here this weekend. My kids are camping with my wife for the first time. I'm missing that experience, right? To me.
You should let them use the house when you're away. I think this is, I'll be honest with you, I think that's mean-spirited. Listen, I'm here. We're not leaving the air conditioning on.
That's it.
You guys are in the garden, in tents.
That's it.
Your ability to react in real time with quick humor is fascinating. And you talk about a process of like what you do as a comedian. Are you a guy sitting in the room writing stuff down? What's the process?
I'm quite sort of stoic about it. I'm like, do less, better. I'm a gag to gag guy, right? I'm joke to joke, which is kind of, it's an interesting way to work. So you're not really trying to find it on stage. You're writing, you know, one-liners. I've got a really good fastball. I try and do some other stuff. I try and like in the late special, I try to do some longer bits and some more observational stuff, which is, it's interesting, try and work another muscle. But basically, like tonight, the only thing I'll worry about tonight is I'll have a piece of paper in my pocket with 10 new jokes on it. And I'll try those after 90 minutes. Do 90 minutes of jokes, and then I'll go, right, here's the new stuff. And try new stuff every single night.
You'll say to the audience, this is new material?
Yeah. This is new material. I haven't learned it. I'm going to read it. Let's see what's funny. Mm. And then with no performance and just reading it, if it gets a big laugh, then okay, it's good. That's good enough. And it's just come after your closer as well. So there's nowhere to hide. Because I'm not interested in B material. Like the annoying thing about comedian is how much B material. I don't care about it. The stuff that doesn't work, you think it's going to be great, and it gets nothing from the audience, like literally nothing, I find kind of hilarious. Like, what happened there? Mm-hmm. I had no idea. And then the stuff that works, great. There's the kind of B-level stuff, which I've got a ton of, which is like, it's okay, but it's not good enough to make the hour. It's not good enough to be in the show.
Why is it B, though? Is it B because they're not laughing enough?
Yeah, the audience. I mean, Lenny Bruce said it better than anyone. The audience is a genius. The audience tell you what is and what isn't acceptable and what is and what isn't funny. That feedback loop is kind of the great advantage that stand-up comedians have over like everyone else in showbiz.
George Carlin didn't do any of that. He almost did the exact opposite. It was almost like he'd create it, then present it, and you either got it or you, like, you know what I mean? It's almost like, I find that fascinating with you. I find that you could write an hour special and then present it, and like you wouldn't care if half the audience didn't think it was as funny as you. I didn't know you were.
No. I think it's all in service, right? It's like that's Bob Dylan. We all have to serve someone, and we serve the audience. It's that thing of like the Vegas thing that the thing I like about Vegas is I saw Manilow last night. Phenomenal. In the room that, or on the site that Elvis used to play. You go, well, this is just a guy of 80, and he's delivering for us. He's come and he's gone, right, this is your night out. I'm going to deliver. I always think about that thing of like, who spent the most money on tickets here? Like in terms of who had to work the hardest to buy a ticket for him and the girl and the kid for the show and to get here and to get the babysitter, to get the food and the drinks, whatever. Like someone had to put in like a 2 days work mm-hmm. to be in the room. You got to deliver. And that thing of like joke to joke, making sure everything's surprising and funny. And, you know, listen, I'm not for everyone, but you want to make it, if people are into this, you want to make it a great night for them.
I don't think a lot of people have that mentality. Of that. I think a lot of people just go out there and just the fact that they're opening their mouth, they think, whatever comes out of it is supposed to be funny. The fact that the testing of material that you're going, this is not quite as good as the last joke, I'm not going to put it in, is I think the work that's kind of missing now in stand-up comedy.
I think jokes are missing. I'm working on a project at the moment with a friend where we're trying to write a book about how to write, like it's 50 different joke types as I see it. And we're working on a book about how to teach that because I think there's a lot of great comics out there. And the problem with our industry, as I see it, is a lot of it is superstition and people going, well, I just kind of find it on stage. And it's almost like music before there was written music. It's like a vibe thing. And it's alchemy. People are trying to turn something into gold mm-hmm. and they're not quite sure. And I'm saying, I think it should be more scientific. It should be more like a written music. Mm-hmm. You can go, because actually sometimes it's just the, you know, and not to get into the weeds on this, I'm sure your listeners aren't interested, but that thing of like, if you do three pullback reveals in a row, the audience don't laugh as hard at the third one. Because even though they don't know anything about joke structure, it's like, he did that card trick the same way three times. Mm-hmm. No magician on the strip would do that. You got to do it differently. You got to find a different way to present it every time. And mixing up the joke types. Like sometimes when a comic is boring to watch, I think, they're only doing two types of jokes. And they're just, that's all there. But if they knew, they'd be able to write, you know, they've got such a creative mind. They're just a little bit, mm-hmm. it's not really taught. It's not really talked about very much.
Yeah.
People don't really talk about how to write jokes.
And have you always done the jokes that are new at the end of, did you started?
I started doing that it was like last year in Australia, I was on tour and I just kind of, on the first night of the tour, I had a bunch of stuff I'd written over Christmas to try and did it the first night. And I went, it's interesting. I really enjoyed it. And the audience kind of liked it was a little Wizard of Oz behind the curtain of, he doesn't know. And the ones that didn't work were actually very interesting for the audience. Like, there's nothing.
Mm.
Like you don't, it doesn't buy you any time. You know that story about, comedians, you can be as, I mean, it's in Seinfeld's documentary. The you can stand on stage, you can be the most famous guy in the world. The audience give you 2 minutes, tops. 2 minutes if you're a legend. And then you better say something funny.
Right.
Not a wonderful meritocracy to comedy.
Yeah. Well, what happens though at the end when you're doing new stuff, if the last new joke doesn't get a big laugh, you just go, well, you guys remember my clothes and how funny that was, right? So good night. Like you just get off without the big laugh?
I don't know if you're, we haven't met properly, but I'm in show business. No. The end of the show is then an interactive bit that always delivers. Don't worry about a damn thing.
Well, you're just saying it's brand new, so you don't know if it's
going to
work.
So that at the end of your set, so you've got your close of your stand-up set, and then I do a thing with the audience where I have them text me. So I've been doing this thing for years where I get the audience, because some people like to heckle me, because I've got kind of a reputation for being quite good with hecklers. So occasionally you get hecklers, and then you get a lot of very clever people at a comedy show that go, look, I've got really funny shit to say. I don't want to shout out. I don't want to shout it out. But I'd love to be involved. And so I put a number up on the screen and they can text in. And people text in. So I haven't seen them, but then things come up on the screen behind me and we read them out. And then there's interaction with the audience at the end of the show, which is a lovely way of...
This is show business, right?
This is phenomenal.
Right? Yeah. The fact that he's used technology and incorporated it into his act in a way to interact with the audience is...
Right.
The opener, you got to see the opener. It's a cold open on my show. And just a screen comes up and just says, hello, I'm the warm-up act. And then it's just reading on stage. And it like runs for 5 minutes and just warms up the audience.
Who's the warm-up? Like, who's saying that?
It's just the screen. The audience are reading it off the screen.
Oh, they're reading off
the screen. And it's amazing how you can like get people into the right rhythm.
Wait, hold on. They're reading this out loud?
No, they're just reading it. They're all reading it. And then you could just, and you press to the next slide and they all laugh. And then the next one, and then you have it. It's really beautifully timed little bit of theater. I tell you where I got it from. I got it from REM on the Green Tour. Saw a tour, nothing's wasted, right? I saw a tour in 1989. I saw REM on tour, and they did this thing at the beginning where they just came up on the screen, just said hello. And the whole, like 3,000 people in the room, everyone's looking at one thing, just focuses the whole room. And every conversation stops. I thought, that's great. That's what I need. I need people to be quiet and I need them to laugh at jokes at about sort of 92 beats a minute, three of them before I come on stage. Just get them in the right space and just sort of controlling it.
So how long does that last?
4 or 5 minutes.
Wow. And these are jokes that you have written?
Yeah. Like there's a couple of generic, like let's test some classic old jokes. So there's a classic old gag kind of comes up like a music hall thing. This is very funny. And you go, okay, great. They get the rhythm of jokes. And then it's got some stuff about put your phone away and you can put your phone on vibrate and shove it up your ass or whatever the thing is. But basically the kind of you can heckle, but it should be funny. All of that stuff is done by the screen. It's kind of interesting to just kind of using the space. I always think someone said something recently to me. I think I need to give more thought to this, but when people come into the auditorium, that's when the show should start. So think about like putting funnier things on the screen as they're coming in and sitting down. That thing, they used to do it in movie theaters. You used to come up with like quizzes on the screen before you'd come. I think that thing of like the whole experience should be the music that plays. I would spend a lot of time thinking about that.
Would you ever see Cirque du Soleil? How like the show starts?
Heterosexual, actually.
What's that?
Heterosexual. Sorry, what was the question?
And I don't know if they do it out here, but I saw Cirque du Soleil once. And when you
did
come,
you? When well, you, once when I, you once come, I guess I was pretty close to a guy. No,
go I'll just thing. Sip my Perrier. When they see
sip,
you.
Sip your Perrier, yes, that's. Yes, well done you.
When they go
the to... masculine mic drop, I'm just going to have some Perrier. I'm just going to have some fizzy Perrier if people are going to suggest that I'm homosexual for seeing Cirque du Soleil.
No, I don't think that at all. That's not a, not like
I've seen all of those shows. I love them.
There's only one. Oh, wait, no, there are various ones. I see.
Amazing.
I see.
Amazing.
Well, I'm saying when you come in and they go to seat you, like I went with my friend one time and they went to seat him and his wife and there was like a clown and they go, hold the tape. For a second, next thing you know, they were taping him around the pole and then they just walked away and he's taped to the pole and his wife doesn't know if she should untape him. And it's like you said, it's
kind of love that thing. I love that thing when you see like something from like another bit of show business, like clowning done well. Like clowning's got a terrible reputation, right? It's just, it's it and it's kids find them creepy, right? And it's John Wayne Gacy. But clowning like, clowning done by like a proper French guy that knows what he's doing. It's just phenomenal.
Right.
And some of the stuff like you do on stage, the theatrical, the movements, I almost feel like it's orchestral. You know, when there's a big knee bend and you're doing like a huge thing, you're conducting the audience. You know exactly where they're moving. It's very interesting that kind of.
Yeah, I find it very interesting that the show starts from the door in because I'm always trying to figure out to your Cirque du Soleil, you know, there's a clown, there's somebody in the audience goofing around, getting the audience ready to see what's about to happen. And the fact that you got it up on the screen and they're participating as a group is...
I used to love that thing. You remember JFL when you did the gala?
Yeah, yeah.
They were, God rest their soul, JFL gone. But the T-shirt guy, where they'd put on a record and he would just have 15 t-shirts on and be throwing them out. And the energy this guy had, I mean, it's nothing of an act and it's everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like focus the whole room on this one dude. And it's great to kind of get that attention.
And how'd you come up with the texting you at the end of the show? Where did that idea come from?
Just from like, you know, people wanting to join in and not kind of, and not being confident enough to shout out. There's a certain kind of subset of people that are very happy shouting out, especially kind of in the UK. It's like a real thing, heckling and joining. It's really seen as joining in, as opposed to they're not trying to ruin the show. There's a big difference between someone going, you know, it's rubbish, or once a comedian interrupting a joke drunkenly and properly adding value. And I always think that wonderful thing about when there's 2,000 people in a room and you all share a sense of humor. You think about the Venn diagram of all the different backgrounds, all the different people that are there, and we've all got this quite dark sense of humor. And you're not the only funny guy in the room. There's other people that are funny. But everyone's funny when they're a kid. We just didn't stop.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Some of them stopped and got proper jobs, but they've still got it. They've still got it. You can tease it out of them.
Yeah.
Is this something
phenomenal? Passion for stand-up is just, well, and the arts in general is just.
Well, but stand-up is like
contagious.
Like, there's jazz, there's the Western, there's stand-up. These are the great things America's given the world. And really, I think you can trace it back.
And Tom Cruise, but continue.
And phenomenal. You can trace it. I've got a Tom Cruise story if you want it. I can trace it all the way back to, I think Carlin and Pryor are like John the Baptist. Those are the guys that came along, and people started going to theaters to see one guy on stage with a microphone. It's like a new medium. It's such a new thing. It's like we get to be early in this. We get to be, I think it all goes back into the pot. I don't think there's any legacy for comedians. It all goes back into the pot, but we get to be part of this.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing sort of art form.
Yeah. There is a fine line between stand up and, hey, we have no excuse for if someone's famous and they just want to make money by people being able to physically lay eyes on them, but they have no discernible talent. What can we do? Oh, well, we'll pretend he's a comedian. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, for every one of you,
I don't know what you've got against Charlie Sheen, but Jesus.
For every one of you, there's like 10 people doing stand-up that like only have people coming because of what they've accomplished on social media in a clubhouse way.
It's great. It's great. But they're in a canoe and there's no paddle and the rapids are coming up and they're just thinking, what's that noise? And we're in show business and we've got a little paddle and we're quite happily just writing jokes and telling jokes. And we've got something. And I think life is about incentives, right? So you come and see Sebastian on stage at the Wynn in Vegas, and you have a fantastic evening. And you say, all tonight is, your tickets are already sold for this evening. You've got no worries this evening. All tonight is a sales pitch for next time.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
And next time they get a chance, they go, we had a great night. We have to go again. We had such fun. We've got to bring our friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that thing of like, if you want ants, you put down sugar. If you get big laughs, they come back. I notice a lot of these guys that come out on tour and don't have it, tour once.
Right. Yep.
Okay. And then they tour the second time, smaller venues. And then they don't tour again.
Yeah.
And that's fine because they made that choice and they're doing other things. And this is like the world ordered a stand-up comedian. You got to honor that.
Right.
Just write jokes, perform. You got your audience, serve them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh man, what a purist. What a purist. I love it.
I think we need to talk to this guy every morning just to get motivated.
Yeah.
And I always carry a pen, but now because of Jimmy Carr, yeah, I'm going to use it.
Yeah.
So you talk about Tom Cruise. There is a segment that we do on this show about Tom Cruise.
Not even on purpose. It kind of
just happened. We ask people, do you have a Tom Cruise story? Have you ever encountered this man? And if so, is the energy palpable? Is it electric? Like,
okay, all right. I have a Tom Cruise story. I'd like to prep you for this. It does involve the moon landings. Are you in?
Whatever. Yeah.
Okay. So I met him at a friend's wedding, and he was
rolling with.
Well, Stanley Tucci got married. Beautiful wedding. Amazing. They didn't have a cake. They had a cheese platter. It was phenomenal. Anyway, Tom Cruise is there because he's filming Mission Impossible in England, and Stanley's an old mate of his. Anyway, so he's there, and I bump into him at the reception the night before, drinks, and I didn't have anything to say to Tom Cruise. So I know a thing or two, my education coming through here. So I said, you work with Stanley Kubrick on Eyes Wide Shut? And he said, yes, I did. I said, I have a question. Did he use the NASA lenses on that movie? And he went, well, how did you know that? And I went, he used the lenses that were used on the Apollo 13 moon mission. He used those lenses. That's why he was able to film Barry Lyndon. Barry Lyndon's filmed by candlelight. No one else could figure out, how is this director able to film this? Well, he had the best lenses ever made by humanity. Now, I don't know if you know anything about NASA.
I don't even know who Barry Lyndon is.
It's a Harvey Keitel movie from the 70s.
It's one of those things where you have to like nod your head and it's act like you know who it is.
Jimmy, do you have more respect if we stop and say we don't understand? Or should we just fake it and let you go?
No, this is fantastic. Yeah, I mean, listen, you've got Google. You can listen to this back.
No, but this is awesome.
So he's this. So Stanley Kubrick, you know who Stanley Kubrick is,
right? Yes, greatest, yes, of course. And I love Eyes Wide Shut.
Greatest director of his generation, right?
Of course.
So if you imagine, so I said to Tom Cruise, why did he have those lenses? And Tom Cruise went, well, I know he had the lenses. I don't know why he had them. I said, well, I've heard a story and I think it might be true. I think when the Cold War was happening, right, there was a Cold War between Russia and America. And it was, people can't imagine it now because they only imagine, they say, oh, the world's in a terrible place. The world was in a terrible place in the 1960s, right? These two superpowers were facing off and the stakes were humanity, right? So the moon mission was a big part of like showing who was dominant, who was most powerful. So when the Americans landed on the moon, you're in show business, do you think they did a rehearsal? Do you think they rehearsed the camera moves? Or you think they just went up there like a couple of guys on a trip with a camcorder and went, we'll just see what happens. So they rehearsed everything.
Wow.
Down to the final detail. They rehearsed it out in the Mojave Desert. They got a director in. Who did they get as a director? Well, they got the best director working in the world. They got Stanley Kubrick in to direct the moves. What are we going to do? How are we going to frame it? What's it going to be? What's that guy going to say when he lands? How are we going to do this thing? They rehearsed everything. So any B-roll you see, anyone that's a moon landing, oh, they never did it. The flags aren't. Yeah, that's B-roll. You're looking at B-roll. Somehow in the 70s, they mixed up some of the actual footage from the moon and some of the B-roll that Kubrick shot. Kubrick never talked about it. Kubrick has loads of references to the Apollo moon missions in later things, just as a little nod. But then he got paid in lenses. NASA doesn't have a garage sale. They didn't sell the stuff afterwards. But he ended up holding that shit because he did for them.
No.
Good Tom Cruise story, right?
What did Tommy C say to all this?
He said, yeah, sounds like something. He was incredibly personable. The energy was terrific.
I think, listen, after hearing this story, bro, this might be the first time Tom Cruise walks away.
Right.
And when he goes on interviews, he says, I got a Jimmy story.
Right. I agree. He probably took this back to Scientology people and said, did you know about Kubrick's lenses?
I tell you, the thing about Tom Cruise that I really liked was he's obviously an incredibly famous guy and very aware of who he is and very giving of his time. He's like absolutely, you know, lots of eye contact and very incredibly charming. And charm, I think, is an interesting thing. Like, I've got a theory on this in stand-up. You've got charm or charisma. It's one or the other, right? So charm is, I come to you. Obama is very, very charming. I come to you. Think about how his rhythm is, how he speaks, the way he tilts his head. He's, I come to you. Charisma is you come to me. Trump is very charismatic. Whatever side of the political line, he's very charismatic. Jennifer Aniston is incredibly charming. Everyone wants to be her friend, literally, metaphorically. Angelina Jolie is incredibly charismatic.
Yeah.
They both get to have sex with Brad Pitt. Don't worry about a thing, ladies. You're one or the other, but you knowing what you are on stage is very valuable, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that thing about like charm is sometimes, charm isn't people like you. It's they think you would like them. I have virtually no charm. I've got a lot of charisma. But knowing what you are is really, really interesting.
Pete.
What do you think you got?
What do you got?
I think I got both.
So close. You're neither. So close.
Have you met the Queen? God rest her soul.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I met the Queen.
Wow. Charisma, charm.
I'm very, very personable. Met the Queen, met the King. Yeah.
All wow, that. Jimmy. Man.
What a life.
You. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not them,
the Queen. The Queen's interesting. Like that's a kind of lovely thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, because it's that thing of it's a figurehead and it's a head of state and it's, you know, if not them, then who? I think it's kind of, I'm quite a royalist. I quite like it.
How do you get invited into that circle? Do you get a call and go, the Queen's having some tea?
I'll tell the story. I did a thing, it was the Queen's Jubilee. So they're getting lots of musicians, like everyone you can think of, from Tom Jones to Rod Stewart to Grace Jones. Everyone's kind of doing a turn, and it's in front of Buckingham Palace is the concert, and it's celebrating 70 years on the throne, and they need some people to do some fill while they change the drum riser, you know, so the comedians are just there to do sort of 2 minutes of nothing really. Mm-hmm. And so I'm there, and I had to do something that was pretty clean, which is unusual for me. And I said, we're all very nervous backstage because we don't know what the etiquette is after the show. You know, how do you address people? And then I looked over at the Queen and went, just call me Mr. Carr.
I love it.
And then like, it must be 5 hours later or whatever, we're getting drunk backstage. We had like a weird incident with Ed Sheeran's a mate of mine, and we were walking on and Stevie Wonder's in front of us. And we were walking back on to do the national anthem. They were all singing the national anthem, God Save the Queen, at the end. And Stevie Wonder said, I don't know this song. And I said, oh, don't worry, it's on prompt. And Stevie Wonder, my dad, you. You know, kind of laughed.
Yeah.
Laughed. And then played on the harmonica just for me and Ed. No one else could hear it, but play riffed over the national anthem on the harmonica just for us. Such a beautiful moment. I mean, just Stevie Wonder there just kind of messing around. It was great. And then about, I don't know, an hour after that, we're in Buckingham Palace having drinks. And I get a tap on my shoulder. And I turn around. And it's Prince William. And he goes, Mr. Carr.
Oh.
Very nice. He did a callback to the gag. Pretty good.
Wow, man.
Pretty good.
Holy shit.
They're very much our Kardashians. We're very fond of them.
Wow, man. That is unbelievable.
So you're in the company of all these different people. Obviously, you feel comfortable kind of, you know, ripping people to shreds, regardless of their status in the world. Growing up, was this something that you were doing throughout school? Were you the class clown? Were you the guy who always making fun of people? Where did this come from?
Yeah, I think I always had that. Like that, our friendship was always based on being able to take and give a joke. My mother was a very funny woman and was very outspoken and loud, and would kind of cause, you know, I think she'd, people would say embarrassing, but never found it embarrassing. She was always very kind of garrulous and fun and would say the unexpected and didn't have much of a filter. Mm-hmm. And so I think I inherited that very early. And then I was always able to kind of, you know, always very good at, you know, making people laugh.
But don't you find, because you're literally like a type of Don Rickles, but, you know, a different delivery style.
I mean, he's the greatest, I think. Well, I think, well, you know, you hear those old school Vegas stories and just...
They are phenomenal.
Phenomenal. Like, yeah. I don't know if people know them because they feel a bit like lost in time. Like, I know you and I would care about them, but that thing of like Marilyn Monroe, well, you know that story about Marilyn Monroe walking into the room?
That one I don't know.
Okay, so they're in the showroom here in Vegas, and Don Rickles is destroying. He's the biggest comic in the world by some margin, right? He's doing 3 shows a night, and they're packed, and people can't get to, I mean, he's doing phenomenal. And he's doing some bit on stage, and he's eviscerating, and he's halfway through a joke. And Marilyn Monroe walks in, and she's the most famous woman in the world. So she's Princess Diana rolled into Angelina Jolie and Taylor Swift all in one. I mean, she's so famous and beautiful. And she walks in the room, and as she walks in, like, every head turns to look. Everyone is, oh my God, this. And Don Rickles, like, as the whole audience, like, lose interest in the joke, he just goes, I thought I told you to wait in the truck. Just so good.
Oh, man.
So good. It feels like it's slightly, you know, he's, I don't know, Mr. Potato Head from Toy Story to a generation of people, but what a phenomenal, but again, it all goes back in the pot. So Jeff Ross is a very good friend of mine and a phenomenal roaster. And I really feel like the stuff lives on. Don Rickles lives on in that roast tradition and in that kind of, and it gets passed forward, and it's kind of great, isn't it?
Well,
it
is. Yeah. And you mentioned Don Rickles in the heyday of Las Vegas, and we're all here hanging out in Vegas. We got shows tonight. You're at the Mirage. We're here at the Wynn. Is that loss that like, I'm going to come see your show tonight, you're going to come see my show tonight? It seems like that was a lot more prevalent back in the 50s and 60s in Las Vegas. And maybe it's just me. It seems very isolated now, where I don't know if there's that crossover of like, entertainers hanging out in Las Vegas together. Like,
I don't think in Vegas so much, but I think actually we've probably got more of that because we have the Comedy Cellar and the Comedy Store. So you have these two exceptional clubs in America that really have changed the way that stand-up comedy is done. I think they're both phenomenal, and I'm very lucky to be able to play them. But that idea of actually the hang, I mean, actually, I've met you and seen you many times at the Comedy Store working on new stuff and just like dropping in and doing a bit. That I feel is our Vegas. Mm. That that showroom there, because the guys used to live here in this in the way that people now live in LA,
mm-hmm.
and they drop into their club and they spend time, and you would meet guys that have been doing it a year or just got past, and then you'd also see, I'm just trying to think of, you know, the old time guys would drop in and do a set. Alan Havey had the best line on comedy. You know Alan?
Havey,
no. Wonderful comic. Yeah, he was in like, he's in Mad Men, I think a little bit, but he's a tidy little actor, but great old school stand-up. And he said, we're out for ourselves, but in it together. Love that line.
What's the line?
We're out for ourselves, but in it together. I love that thing. There's a great camaraderie with stand-up. It's not like being an actor. Actors, who's the best? Who's in competition with who? Who's the, there's only one guy can be James Bond. We sort of don't be the best, be the only. You know, you avoid competition through authenticity.
True.
No one is better at being you than you. No one can do what you do.
Yeah.
You bring something very special to the party. And people respond to that.
Yeah.
It's lovely because when no one's in competition. It's a weird thing. I think when people start out, it takes them a while to figure that out.
Yeah.
I'm just doing my thing, no matter what they're doing.
But the idea that we're together too, a lot of young comics and people that don't do stand-up can't relate when they go, isn't it scary when you're bombing? And I always try to tell them, well, when you're bombing and you're young, you're bombing what everybody else on the show is bombing too. You all are terrible. So it's not like you're playing some amazing show where you're the only one bombing.
You win or you learn.
Yeah.
That's it, isn't it? That's the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Although we really need to discuss this bombing thing. You've been doing this a while now.
Come on. Yeah. It's been phenomenal, Chad, with you, man. I'm so glad. See, this is what I was going to say about the insulting stuff.
What a privilege for you.
Do you ever, it is for me. When you talk to somebody.
Feels like it's a big deal. They say never meet your heroes, but I think you've really, you've had a great time.
I did. And I'm going to ask for a photo with you after the law, and you're going to insult me for it.
Is this part of the Make-A-Wish thing?
But do you, if you're, when you're chatting with somebody, like Don Rickles sort of aspect, if they must be like waiting for you to, all right, when is he going to insult me? And if he doesn't insult me, does that mean he's not having a good time? Like, there's just so many expectations having a Jimmy Carr conversation.
I think, listen, we're in a studio. We know what we're doing here. We're all fellow travelers. I think it's that thing of like in stand-up as well. I don't know when you felt successful in stand-up, but there's a comedy store in London and I got paid like $200 to do a show there. And that's it for me. Everything past that has been gravy.
Mm-hmm.
It's just gone early on. It's just like, you know, the fame and fortune stuff, great. Like fame and fortune is like a proxy for heaven in our world, in our secular society. Oh, if I'm rich and famous, everything will be fine. It's great, but it's very ethereal. And you go, actually, just being paid to do this, the job was the same then as it is now.
Yeah.
Write jokes, tell jokes, make people laugh, make their night great. That's the job. And we're all doing the same job.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Well said, man. And we know you're a busy guy. We appreciate your time coming down here. Obviously, you draw a crowd, and we would love to get a. Yeah, that's.
Yeah, and for our listeners, I know some of our listeners.
I thought Tom Hardy had shut down, but the people out here.
Jimmy
people
Carr,
out here have begged to differ.
He's got a new special coming out on Netflix. You need to. If some of our listeners, no disrespect to you, because you are international fame of Tom Cruise level.
No, but
if you're not familiar with Jimmy Carr,
but
see
some
his
of your
stuff.
Some
he's
of
so
your
good.
Listeners. Barely, yeah.
Barely know us.
Yeah.
Well, thanks
again.
Great.
What an absolute pleasure.
You got it. Thanks for joining us here on the Pete and Sebastian Show in Las Vegas. Jimmy Carr tonight
Jimmy
at
Carr,
the Mirage.
Man.
Go check him out.
It will never be uptown. It's bound to be downtown.
The show has ended.
I have virtually no charm. I've got a lot of charisma. But knowing what you are is really, really interesting.
Pete.
What do you think you got?
What do you got?
I think I got both.
Jimmy,
you're so close. You're neither.